in which the theme of the program is money and how it can buy you smartphone screens and ad-free music and a place, perhaps, in history. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 30th day of March. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. Hey, so listen, how many times a day you figure you look at your phone or your tablet? Dozens? Hundreds, maybe? Lots. Anyway, right? We can agree on that. I ask because the business news of the day today links directly back to that few square inches of glass you and I spend oh so very much time looking at. Foxconn, the Taiwan-based 800-pound gorilla of contract manufacturing with its city-sized Chinese factories in which hundreds of thousands of workers make most of the iPhones sold on this planet, is buying Sharp, the century-old premium electronics brand from Japan that has fallen on hard times lately. Price tag is a cool $3.5 billion American. But while the headline does say Sharp and Foxconn, it is a story, really, about Apple, once you get right down to it. From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets us going.
First, Foxconn. Over the years, it has done very well from its close supply chain relationship with Apple, as each new iPhone launched and instantly sold in the millions across the globe.
That requires the mobilization of an enormous amount of labor, very efficiently and at a good cost.
But Harvard business professor Willie Shi says it's getting harder to make money that way, with Chinese wages and production costs rising. So the no-nonsense contract manufacturer goes and buys a cutting-edge electronics brand.
Foxconn is trying to move up the value chain. That is one of the attractive aspects of Sharp. They have these IGZO displays, very attractive for high pixel density, high resolution screens.
Sharp also brings plenty of trouble in the form of financial liabilities. But Foxconn faces another problem, says S&P equity analyst Angelo Zeno, and that's its biggest, best customer.
There's always a risk that Apple could stumble here.
Apple could lose market share, its next big eye thing could flop, or it could spread more work around to Foxconn's competitors.
Unfortunately, Apple, given that they're the biggest acquirer of hardware equipment on the planet, they're going to always be, a major purchaser.
Peter Cohen at Babson College Business School says this whole ecosystem faces a challenge going forward.
The maturing of the smartphone industry, Apple's slowing down, and any supplier to Apple is also slowing down because the iPhone is slowing down. Everybody's sort of scrambling for restoring growth to where it used to be in the good old days, but it won't happen unless everybody gets on a new growth curve.
Smart clothes, wearable AI, or virtual reality, anyone? I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew is his name, was up and at him early in Washington today talking sanctions, specifically how U.S. sanctions have changed in the past few years. The words targeted and engineered came up more than a couple of times. And also, why sanctions are the answer when you need something more than diplomacy, a little bit less than military. However, Lew cautioned as well that sanctions ought not be applied frivolously. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has this look at U.S. sanctions policy today.
Secretary Lew said in his remarks that in the past, sanctions were an on or off sort of a thing, a general embargo against dealing with another country.
You cut a country off and it had broad impact on the general public.
Cuba, anyone?
Fast forward to the Russia sanctions after Ukraine. Very highly engineered and targeted.
Which means what exactly? Elizabeth Rosenberg is with the Center for a New American Security. She also used to work on sanctions at Treasury. She says post 9/11, there's been this bigger focus on trying to change behavior the U.S. doesn't like by sanctioning bad actors.
Specific weapons traffickers, specific terrorist cartels and terrorist groups, proliferators as well, and we'll name them specifically and we'll name their networks.
Starting around 2010, Rosenberg says there's been this second wave of change, where sanctions go after specific kinds of access to the U.S. financial system and specific financial products.
Barring the ability for some Russian companies and banks to raise capital to service their debt in European and U.S. markets, whether or not it has worked, I think, is a story that hasn't yet been finished.
Instead of a sledgehammer, you're trying to use a laser.
Jeffrey Shaw is with the Peterson Institute. He says better technology has been a game changer in allowing us to find pressure points and push on them. But he says lots of targeted sanctions can be harder for the companies trying to comply with them.
It's harder to figure out what types of activities are permissible and what kinds of activities fall into the gray area or even be sanctionable under U.S. law.
He says that's keeping lots of lawyers very busy. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Strong start, slightly less strong finish in equities today. I might be just a hair ahead of things here, but the March unemployment report comes out on Friday morning. Could be some waiting and seeing going on Wall Street. Either way, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Nobody ever said the U.S. tax code is transparent or easy to use, and you can't take advantage of many of its provisions if you don't know about them. So enter now the Earned Income Tax Credit. It's considered to be one of the most effective anti-poverty programs this country has, designed to help get families over the poverty line by offsetting how much low-income workers have to pay in federal income taxes. But in Philadelphia, thousands of eligible residents don't claim that credit at all. From WHYY, Kitty Colinari reports the city is trying to change that.
Even before tax day, Philadelphia resident Rosalind Sanders is ahead of the game. She's at a local community development corporation getting her taxes done, and it's the second time she's come here. Sanders is back because last year, the organization helped her and her husband get a big refund by figuring out they qualified for the Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC. She says they got a check in the mail for more than $3,000.
I felt so good. I came back and brought these guys pizza. Just the whole staff, because I really appreciate what they had done.
In addition to four boxes of pizza, Sanders says she used the money to pay her car loan and other bills that had gotten behind. Sanders used to file her own taxes, and when she saw the EITC on the forms, she ignored it.
I thought it was just for certain people, like if they had children. I never thought we were eligible for it.
There are a lot of people like Sanders in Philadelphia. About 200,000 low-income residents are eligible for the EITC, but the city estimates 20% of them didn't claim the tax credit last year. Revenue Commissioner Frank Breslin says those people left a combined $100 million on the table.
The numbers kind of just jumped out at us, and we thought this is something that we should really engage in.
Breslin says the city held focus groups to find out why so many people weren't getting the EITC. A lot of people just didn't know it existed, or they couldn't afford good tax preparation services and didn't know where to get help. So this year, Philadelphia is spending more than $1 million on an awareness campaign. There's a website with information translated into five different languages, posters on buses and subways, and there are ads on Pandora.
Hey, Philadelphians, you may be eligible for a federal earned income tax credit refund up to $6,242.
They're also paying a street team to go into neighborhoods where a lot of residents could be eligible. On a recent afternoon, Matthew Bate was handing out information to business owners.
And also, I want to know if I can leave a poster that has the different locations where people can file for taxes throughout the city for free. No problem.
But most of the money for the campaign is being spent on two nonprofits to provide free tax preparation services across the city. Michelle Arthur runs one of the free tax sites in North Philadelphia and says so far the campaign seems to be working.
Everyone's asking. All the clients are now asking, do I qualify? Because they're aware that this is another credit, even though they didn't know that they may have been receiving it the whole time.
Recently, Arthur told a woman she'd be getting more than $1,000 through the program.
And she just did a little happy dance in her chair, and, you know, she said, I'm not going to be loud, but woohoo.
Revenue Commissioner Breslin says the city is tracking the success of the campaign by collecting data from the free tax sites.
So we really felt, I think, a responsibility to let the citizens know that this is available for them so that, you know, it can help them in whatever way, pay bills, buy a car.
Breslin hopes the city can find a way to keep the campaign going next year. In Philadelphia, I'm Kitty Colinari for Marketplace.
You want hot industries of the past couple of days? Look no further than the music streaming business. Pandora's found a return to that company as CEO. Spotify raised $1 billion in new financing, and SoundCloud has now launched its long-awaited subscription service. For $10 a month, you can get yourself access to SoundCloud's library, 125 million tracks, give or take, including a lot of underground stuff you won't find on other services. And, oh yeah, no ads. Sally Herships looks at SoundCloud, and it's trying to remix itself in a very crowded space.
Spencer Claiborne is 20. He lives in Missouri, and he's a huge fan of SoundCloud. Here's why. Not too long ago, Claiborne was in the hospital. He has leukemia.
And I took a lot of comfort in an artist called Cloud.
Claiborne says he discovered the music on SoundCloud.
The music of Cloud really got me through a lot of difficult nights and days.
So once he recovered, Claiborne went on to SoundCloud and sent Cloud, the musician, a message thanking him. And Cloud wrote back.
That's something that doesn't really exist, the ability to kind of communicate one-on-one with an artist that you love.
Vicky Nauman is a digital music consultant. She says that kind of community is one of the reasons SoundCloud has such a large and loyal following, 175 million users, and all of them are free to upload their own music.
When I heard that they were going to launch with 125 million songs, I thought, oh, I don't know, that sounds awful.
But she says that's what makes SoundCloud SoundCloud. Musicians don't have to go through a record company like they do on other streaming sites. Lots of SoundCloud users also upload remixes and mashups. Susan Federspiel is with Landor, a global branding firm.
I don't think that Apple or Spotify or some of the other brands have really built that community around their brand the same way that SoundCloud has been able to do it.
The key for the new subscription service SoundCloud Go will be to bring in new users and generate more revenue. But SoundCloud is entering a very crowded space. So Federspiel says the company is hoping to take on its competitors by offering mainstream music as well as everything else. And as for Spencer Claiborne in Missouri, will he pay up?
You know, I think I will.
Claiborne says SoundCloud's interface is still clunky. It needs a lot of work, but he's willing to wait it out. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I'm really trying to get people to pay more attention to the history of our country and therefore be better citizens by knowing more about our country's history.
Patriotic philanthropy straight ahead, but first, yeah, sure, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 83 points today, 0.4%, closed at 17,716. The NASDAQ gained 22 points, also 0.4%, 48.69. The S&P 500 up 8 points, yes, also 0.4%, 2,063. We told you about Foxconn's acquisition of Sharp and the Apple connection. Apple up 1.7% today. Google up 0.3%. Microsoft gained 0.6%. Carnival reported better than expected earnings. Its stock cruised up 5.4%. Royal Caribbean also got a lift. Stock gain of 5.6% today. Keeping with the theme of mobility here, planes, trains, and automobiles or electric cars or something, Tesla is going to unveil the Model 3 tomorrow, its entry-level electric car. The company's stock, however, reversed 1.4% today. Ford, though, added 1.1%. Lululemon, or Lululemon, as I heard today at some point. The athletic wear company stitched up more than 10.5% because of strong holiday sales. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 1.82%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The U.S. Department of Agriculture calls it HPAIH. Five, highly pathogenic avian influenza H5, bird flu to you and me. Last year, it wiped out nearly 50 million birds in this country to the tune of $500 million in losses to the American poultry industry. It can be traced, this most recent global epidemic can, to a single lake in southeastern China where most migratory birds in Asia spend their winters. And while they're there, they mingle with domesticated birds from duck and geese farms nearby. Our China correspondent, Rob Schmitz, took a little field trip.
It's early spring. The million or so birds on Poyang Lake will soon migrate as far north as the Arctic Ocean. More migratory birds spend their winters here on China's largest freshwater lake than anywhere else in Asia. But they're not the only birds here, says Nanji Wetland Nature Reserve Manager Wang Songxian.
There are farmers raising all sorts of poultry here, too.
At this time of year, the wild birds look for food on the farms, and there's lots of contact between wild animals and domesticated poultry.
In other words, now's the ideal time for the avian influenza virus to spread. And a few miles away is the ideal place, a rice paddy filled with thousands of domesticated ducks. United States Geological Service's Diane Prosser says from here, the virus begins to spread.
It's going to move from wild birds into a poultry system where it has a capacity to mutate very quickly and into a different form.
Inside domesticated ducks, the virus can mutate from a non-lethal form into a lethal one.
Meaning that the domestic birds may have that same strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza virus or one that's, you know, slightly evolved, and that it's able to go back into the wild birds and infect them.
Infected birds then carry it thousands of miles away. That's what happened around 15 years ago when the deadly strain H5N1 began to spread, killing hundreds of millions of birds and hundreds of humans around the world, causing $20 billion worth of damage. That's why scientists from around the world are worried about Poyang Lake.
So in the Poyang Lake region, there's almost 9 million people. Plus, you've got this amazing situation, dynamic, like mixing bowl of people and wildlife and birds with all different levels of biosecurity, from the backyard farm to the very large, you know, highly commercialized biosecure farm.
The Mean family farm on the shores of Poyang Lake is more of a backyard type, with acres of rice paddies and thousands of ducks ranging freely. I asked the sister and brother team Min Donlang and Mi Xiaoping if they're worried about the bird flu.
Of course we're worried. When wild birds come here, we're not allowed to chase them away or shoot them. They're protected animals. Years ago on TV, we heard it was spreading near here, so we kept our ducks inside. Each duck is worth $5. If one of them gets the flu, all of them could die and we'd lose everything.
Learning about a local spread of the virus over television raises the question, does the government ever visit them to inspect their farm or to help them prevent the spread of the virus?
No, nothing at all. The government doesn't do anything for us. Nobody is in charge.
Yes, they should do more, but never happened.
Guo Fusheng, who works at the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization in Beijing, admits China's government isn't doing enough to prevent the spread of the virus.
They did some, sampling, surveillance around Poyang Lake, but it's not a systematic research.
China has required poultry farmers to vaccinate their flocks, but enforcement, says Guo, is lax. Quarantining infected poultry, as U.S. farmers were forced to do last year, is a challenge in a country where small-scale farms are the norm. China has, though, swiftly shut down live bird markets like this one when avian flu spreads to humans. This market in Nanchang, the largest city near Poyang Lake, is filled with ducks, chickens, pigeons, and other animals. This is a common sight in China because consumers here prefer to buy live poultry, partly due to a deep distrust of the quality of the meat from factory farms. But experts say this is an ideal environment for bird flu to circulate and mutate into a deadly human virus. Duck vendor Li Peixiang bristles at the very mention of avian influenza.
No, no, no. There's no bird flu here. Never.
Perhaps, but 2 years ago, two people died of yet another strain of flu that had never been fatal to humans. Chinese health inspectors traced the virus to live poultry markets here in Nanchang. Separate research identified Poyang Lake as a major source of that strain, and risk of more flu strains coming out of China will likely grow. Consumer demand for meat and poultry will rise along with China's consumer economy, and increased poultry production brings more opportunity of new avian flu strains to emerge. In Jiangxi Province, China, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Right up there at the top of the list of private equity firms in this country is one called the Carlyle Group. It was co-founded and is co-CEO'd by David Rubenstein. Mr. Rubenstein has made a name for himself in a lot of ways. Running Carlyle is one. Being rich is another. Buying a copy of the Magna Carta is yet a third. Yes, that Magna Carta. Also, a month or so ago, pitching in a few spare million dollars to restore the Lincoln Memorial, so we called him up to talk about it. Mr. Rubenstein, welcome to the program, sir.
My pleasure to be here.
What is it about, I guess you call it patriotic philanthropy. What is it about that that makes you give your money away?
Patriotic philanthropy, in my view of it, means that you are trying to remind people of your country's heritage, its history, its traditions, the good and the bad. And that's what I'm trying to do. When I buy historic documents or try to fix certain monuments, I'm really trying to get people to pay more attention to the history of our country and therefore be better citizens by knowing more about our country's history.
You've been in the news most recently for your contributions to saving, refurbishing, I guess, the Lincoln Memorial. You also did the Washington Monument a number of years ago. I can't help but wonder, though, whether those things specifically aren't the responsibility of the government to pay for.
Well, of course, the government of the United States can always pay for anything it wants to pay for. But right now, for example, the National Park Service has roughly $11 billion of needs that are not being funded. So, yes, the Lincoln Memorial is something that the government could, if it had the money, to fix up. And I think citizens coming ahead and trying to do these kind of things is probably a good idea.
How does it work? Does the head of the National Park Service call you up and say, listen, Mr. Rubenstein, we need, you know, $17 million for the Lincoln Memorial?
In that particular case, I did approach the head of the Park Service, and I thought I might be interested in doing something with the Lincoln Memorial. He came back and told me what the needs were. I did a tour, and then we agreed that it would be a good thing if I put up a certain amount of money and the federal government put up a certain amount as well when we get it done.
Do you think you're getting your money's worth when you make the – because they are investments, right? Do you think you're getting your money's worth?
I think that our citizens are helped by having some of these things restored, and I think I'm doing something useful, but obviously everything's in the eye of the beholder, and I'm sure there's some people who say that let the federal government do everything, and if the federal government doesn't have the money, it shouldn't be done, but that's just not my point of view.
As you've said, the federal government runs deficit, we've got debt, and I wonder if one of the reasons we have that problem, first of all, there is government spending, obviously, but then there's a tax structure that seems to be in need of some overhaul, and I'm wondering whether you could see a way toward a tax reform scheme that would let the well-off among us and corporations with money overseas make that contribution to what you consider civic duty.
Well, I worked in the White House under President Carter, and we tried at that time to have tax reform, and I learned then that tax reform is very difficult to do. I think comprehensive tax reform would be a good thing for our country, but I've thought that for many years, and you know, obviously Congress moves slowly. And on any given day, they can change the tax laws. So if I wait for them to change the tax laws to make sure there's more money to do the things that I want to get done, I'd be waiting a long time.
Well, let me ask it in a more pointed way then. I mean, you've been active in trying to maintain something called the carried interest loophole, which is...
I haven't been active in it. I don't think I've talked to a member of Congress about that in 5 years or so. So active is not quite right.
How about vocal? Would you settle for vocal?
I really haven't been. It's not my major focus. Of the 1,000 things I'm worried about, that's not number... You know, it's not even the top 1,000. If somebody wanted to change that particular law, they're free to do so at any given time. And I think as part of the comprehensive tax reform, anything should be considered.
What is your major focus economically? How are you feeling about the economy today?
I think the economy is going to grow at about 1.5% or so this year. Our dollar is very strong, so it's hard to export as much as we would like to export. It's a slow growth situation, but it's not as bad as it could be. We're not in a recession, for example.
Can I throw a yet on there? We're not in a recession yet, or do you reject that?
Well, since World War II, the United States has had recessions on average every 7 years. But sometimes we've gone 9 years, almost 9.5 years without a recession. I do think at some point we'll probably have a slowdown, but I don't know exactly when that will be. Nobody really knows.
Let me try one more thing with you, sir, and then I'll let you go. I do a thing every now and then with people in the know about interest rates and the Federal Reserve, and I try to get them to tell me in 5 words or less what Janet Yellen is thinking right now. So now your turn. Go ahead.
I think we will see steady as you go
Until at least November. Seven.
I'm not that good at counting.
Says David Rubenstein. Mr. Rubenstein, thank you very much for your time, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
This final note on the way out today, we talk about a lot of different kinds of economic measurements on this program, right? CPI, Consumer Price Index, GDP, of course, Gross Domestic Product. Also the MUI, the Men's Underwear Index. No, I am not making this up, although it is admittedly not officially measured by the government. It is, however, championed by Alan Greenspan, the former chair of the Federal Reserve. It basically says men buy underwear when they feel pretty good about the economy, and that when they, okay, we, start buying underwear, it means the beginning of an economic recovery, which is A, gross, but B, also, I digress. Quartz reports that the sale of boxers, briefs, and boxer briefs is up $1.1 billion since 2009, which, as it happens, tracks quite nicely, thank you very much, with the actual end of the recession. Go figure. We can turn anything into an economic indicator, gang. Anything at all. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 83 points today, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 22 points, also 0.4%. The S&P 500 up 8 points. The trifecta here, 0.4%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.